he said those very words. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity I'm offering you, he said.
That's Wayne Solomon, a tease for the encounter he had in Egypt. And that's coming up. A metaphysician, he's traveled the world, and he's had some extraordinary experiences. This is a book of essays, and he shares some of those experiences, including a UFO encounter. An interesting nugget concerning the JFK assassination. I don't know if you've heard this anywhere else. It's the first time I've heard it. It's actually a bombshell. He has four fiction books. The current nonfiction book is called Journey Across Forever, a magical, provocative odyssey across the ages, around the world and into the great beyond. It's a series of essays. John Alexander writes a foreword, author of Communion. Whitley Strieber offers an endorsement. This wonderful journey through light years and mysteries will inspire and motivate the reader to look deeper into the world around us. It frees the mind to wonder, and that is a beautiful thing. His website, WayneSolomon.com. And now we dive in.
Tell us about Egypt.
Hi, yes. I went to Egypt. Was my number one place to go to in the world. I had just been to the Himalayas, to India, and to the Far East. I had really traveled all through that area, and I was really full of, you might say, the riches of all that travel, but I was also feeling a bit exhausted. But I was determined the one place I wanted to get to more than any was to get to Cairo and to go to the Giza Plateau and see the Great Pyramid. So eventually I got on a plane and I flew into Egypt. And my whole thing at that point was I was fairly exhausted from traveling for months on end. And I was determined I would just go straight to the pyramid and see the pyramids and the Great Sphinx. I did that on day one when I arrived in Cairo. And when I got there, I found there were all these, what I call camel hucksters. They were men that were in jalabas and turbans, and they were absolutely determined that tourists ride these camels around the Great Pyramid and so forth. And that's the way they made their living. But to me, that was like the last thing I wanted. I wanted to have what I would think of as a spiritual experience. I was about to see the most incredible buildings on the face of the earth, the most mysterious megalithic construct we'd ever had on this earth. So it was a whole attitude about going to the Great Pyramid that I did not want to deal with these men who were after me all the time to ride their camels. I got past them, and I subsequently joined a group of tourists who went into the Great Pyramid. It was interesting, but for those who have been to the Great Pyramid, they find there's no hieroglyphics inside. It's very barren. There's not a lot to see, although there's a certain pathway that's very interesting, and then you get into the King's Chamber, but everything's fairly barren and just rock. So I left a bit disappointed the first day, and I didn't feel like I'd had the experience I was after. So I went back into Cairo, and I went to my hotel, and I spent the night, and then the next morning got up, didn't quite know what I was going to do, but I, walking around the city, and I came to the Khan el Khalili Bazaar. Now, I went in there, and I was not really looking to buy anything. I happened into a particular shop that had a lot of hookahs and various interesting things, shall we say, Egyptian statues of obelisks and the Great Sphinx and so forth. And this man who was at the shop, he kind of spotted me as someone. I got the impression he was going to try to get money off me, which is typical. And, I don't hold it against anybody, but I was not about to buy anything. But this man was quite interesting in that he said, "None of this tourist stuff for you." He said, "I can tell you're looking for something more interesting, more intriguing." He said, come with me to the back of the shop, and I will show you something that I hardly show anyone." something very special just for you. So I thought, okay, this is the con, and I'll play along, but I'm not going to buy anything. Well, lo and behold, he opened up a safe, and he pulled out a box, and then he pulled out a little bronze sphinx that was very heavy when I put it in my, when it was put in my hand. I thought, wow, this thing is heavy, and it's very artistic, really beautifully done. And he admitted this had been basically stolen from a museum. I sell it to you now for a really good price, he said. And the telltale thing about the little sphinx was that on the bottom, there were two little sections that were cut away. And I surmise this is where the name of the museum and probably a catalog number had been cut from the bottom of it. I was young and I was intrigued with this, and I thought, oh my God, I got to have it. And he made me an offer that I could not refuse. So I bought the little sphinx and I headed out of there. Now, what happened next gets very intriguing because it's very hot there in Cairo, needless to say. And this big Khan El Khalili Bazaar is a giant tent-like structure, so it's very hot. So there was a restaurant in there that was air-conditioned, so I went in, and I ordered a drink, and then I, like, pulled out the Sphinx and set it on the table, and I was admiring it. Well, across the room, there was a young man, an Egyptian, who was also looking at it, and he was looking at me, and he came over, and he said, do you mind if I sit down? And we started talking, and I was a little bit apprehensive, and I wanted to hide the Sphinx, but he said, let me see that. And he told me, he said, this was stolen from a museum. He said, you want to put that away? Now, he didn't tell me, you know, you got to give it back or anything. So it's like part of the way the culture is, like there's a lot that goes on there that's a bit underhanded, shall we say. I let him look at it, and he was very impressed, and he said, why don't we go out to my house? And he said, I live just near the Great Pyramid, he said, and I think I could make it a very interesting afternoon for you. And I said, really? So tell me more, you know? It was all intriguing, but it was also a bit worrisome. I didn't know what this man was quite up to.
Okay.
And so the young guy, his name was Mo. Go ahead.
Also add what he told you about the man that you purchased this from, because this also adds another element of maybe you being anxious or nervous.
Yes. The idea was that they would sell you a real, genuine Egyptian artifact, and then follow you and more or less attack you and take it back and resell it. Like an underworld thing, an underworld vibe going on with it.
Okay.
But Mo was cool. He was like, look, I'm going to get you out of here. You want to get out of here? You can come over to my house. And he said, I have hashish and I have a hookah and I will make it very interesting for you. We will go to my house and smoke, and then I will get you into the Great Pyramid by yourself. Now, my eyes lit up at this, like, oh, my God, you know, I was looking for a spiritual experience of the Great Pyramid, and we're talking the hashish would elevate the mind, shall we say, and expand the mind and perceptions and so forth, like it could be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And he said those very words. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity I'm offering you, he said. I suspected he had an ulterior motive, but I didn't know what it was at that point. So being young and open to risk, shall we say, at that point, I went forward. We hopped on a bus, a rickety old bus, and rode it out to where he lived. And sure enough, over the tops of the houses, I could see the head of the great Sphinx. Mm. It was the golden sandstone in the bright Egyptian sun. And it was like, oh my God, there's the Sphinx head towering over these houses. So we got off the bus. He said, yes, I live down here. And we saw his house, and there was an elderly woman dressed all in black with the veil kind of not over her face, but over her hair. And she was sweeping away on the sidewalk at the side of the house. And Mo went up. He said, wait here. He had me wait on the sidewalk. He said, wait here. And yeah, I could tell they were having strong words. And he was determined, though, that she should go away, that he was going to use the house. And he had me coming in, this Westerner. So strong words flew, but eventually he chased her off, literally his arms flapping. We went inside, and he pulled out this huge hookah and set it on the coffee table in the middle of the room. I was quite intrigued, you know, being in a real Egyptian's home. Like, I had never had that experience. So I was looking at all the different things, the decorations and so forth in the house. And then he pulled out the ball of hashish and rolled it. And sure enough, we sat down and smoked, and I was soon going through the roof. Now, he, at that point, tried to talk to me about what his ulterior motive was, which was, namely, he had heard about a sponsorship program, and if he had someone in America who would sponsor him, he could go to America, and that was his dream, to go to America and make money and so forth and do whatever. So, but at that point, I was in no frame of mind for that kind of talk, and I tried to talk him out of it. You know, like, this is not the time to be talking business, Mo. So then I suggested, look, this is the time to go. Like, what, go to the Great Pyramid? You told me you could get me in the Great Pyramid by myself. And I can't think of anything more exciting to me right now. So we'll talk business later, I said. But he said, oh, it's very, very hot. And it was scorching hot, like well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And he said, you won't be able to handle this, you know. And I said, look, we got to do it. This is my dream now. And you made a promise. So reluctantly, he took me out of the house, and we went down the street and up this hill. And when I got to the top of the hill, there they were, the three pyramids and the Sphinx, in gleaming sunshine, like golden sunshine. And I was in a state of mind that it was just out of this world for me to have that view. So I said, let's go. I really want to do this. So we went down the hill, and eventually we got wound our way around to where there were three men guarding the Great Pyramid. They were young men in charge of looking after mainly tourist groups going in and out. So Mo had a word with him, and he told me, look, I've talked to him. When you go inside, you're going to give one of the men some money, and then he'll let you in there for a time by yourself. And I'd already been there the day before, so I knew about the Grand Gallery and the King's Chamber and all of that. So I said, that's perfect, let's do it. So a tourist group came out, and then it was my turn to go in. And I went in and gave the man a bit of money, and he went off. And then there I was, alone in the Great Pyramid. And I made my way up the ramp of the Grand Gallery and into the King's Chamber. And the so-called sarcophagus is in there, which I don't really think is sarcophagus, but I said, this is it. I'm climbing inside. So I climbed inside, And at that point, you can imagine that I was flying along in fine form. It was exhilarating, to say the least. Like, I'd read so much about all the mysteries associated with the Great Pyramid. One of the things about it is that this granite, so-called sarcophagus, is made, it's like the hardest stone, and they have perfect corners inside there, and some of these engineers who have looked into this have determined that only some kind of high-powered drills could have worked their way into this granite to make the corners as perfect as they are. So I'm like feeling the inside of the sarcophagus and thinking, my God, who built this? You know, was it extraterrestrials? Was it an advanced group from like former times that some culture that no longer was around, like, you know, the myth of Atlantis and this sort of thing? Like, this pyramid has all kinds of mathematical precisions that you have to read about if you haven't. And it's just one of the most remarkable buildings on the face of the earth. So all of these thoughts were going through my mind that there I was inside this place. It was absolutely silent. I was all alone. I didn't have any disturbing, like, tourists talking or this sort of thing. And I was really, really into it. Like, I really, really was flying along. And then, to my great surprise, the lights went out. The lights just, boom, gone. And I was in the blackest black as you can imagine. It was just so dark and silent. But I didn't panic. I just soared. For those interested, you can read about this in The Journey Across Forever. It's a quite exciting, I think, chapter about the way I was feeling and things I was thinking and sensing and so forth. But a bit of time went by, and somehow a warning came to me that I needed to get out of there at a certain point. And I could just, if you've ever had an intuitive flash, that was it. Like, that was the kind of thing that just hit me at a certain point. And I took it that I needed to get out of there. Now, that was not an easy thing, considering my state of mind. And having rubbery legs, you might say, walking in 100-degree heat across the desert, or the Sahara, at the edge of the Sahara anyway. So, but I struggled up, and I struggled out of sarcophagus. Now, it was pitch black. And I'm thinking, what is going on here, you know? But I had a very solid sense that everything was fine. I was going to be fine, but I needed to get out of there quickly. Mm-hmm. And I made my way across the room. I found the doorway. And then I navigated my way down the Grand Gallery's ramp, and there was a very thin sliver of light coming in through the door that would be the exit. So I walked out into the blinding Egyptian sun. Oh, my God, it was like my eyes from pitch black to the golden sunlight of Egypt. It just overwhelmed me, and I couldn't see a thing for a while. But I reached into my bag, and I finally found my sunglasses, and I put those on. And when I could see again, I looked over across the way where the three men, the security guards, were. And Mo was there still with them. And they were chatting away. They didn't notice me, though. They hadn't noticed me. But then I looked up the hill a little ways, and there were two policemen coming down the hill toward them. And I thought about how I had this Sphinx in my bag. Mm-hmm. I was high on hashish. Mm-hmm. And I could have gone to prison if I was taken in. Let's face the facts, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I said, I got to get out of here. I cut and ran. Now, the day before, I had been there, so I knew where the bus stop was. Fortunately, it was in the opposite direction of where those four men and then the two policemen were.
Yeah.
Well, they were all looking at me at a certain point, all eyes on me.
Uh-huh.
And when I saw that, that's when I cut and ran. I made my way as quickly as I could to the bus stop. Fortunately, the gods were with me, or the angels were with me. Somebody was with me of a higher nature, because not only had I been warned to get out of there in some intuitive flash, but the bus was just ready to take off. I jumped on the bus, handed the man a few coins, made my way to the back of the bus, and I could hear him, you know, revving the engine, ready to take off. He did. He took off slowly, because it was a rickety old bus again. But I was looking out the back window, and I could see the policeman running after the bus, waving at it, shouting. But the driver, he didn't seem to care, or he didn't hear it. He gunned the engine, and off we went. And I was thanking my lucky stars at that point that I had escaped. But that was my story. I entitled that chapter Cairo Confidential, and it was one of the great adventures of my life, which had a happy ending, fortunately.
Yes.
It could have been life-changing in a very negative way.
Like an Indiana Jones flashback.
Yes.
The reason I opened
That's
with that,
it.
You had John Alexander do the foreword to your book, and he gives a substantial amount of copy to your book. There are some other incidents that you have shared that fit with his stories that he includes in Reality Denied. And again, to read about the experience you had in the, not really a sarcophagus, the chamber, is to find out more about that experience that was transcendent. And so how did you connect with John?
My last book I published was a work of fiction entitled Crimson Firestorm March. And it's briefly, the story is about two space groups that are trying to be the first on Earth to blast off for Mars and set up an interplanetary colony there. I was intrigued to write that story because I had read a newspaper article saying that a group called Mars One, now this is real, they had announced that they were, you know, wanted to be the first to go to Mars. And they had over 1,000 applicants who said, take me, you know, I want to go. Like, I was just amazed to think that an average ordinary person would think, okay, I'll give up all my life here on Earth because it's a one-way ticket at the moment. If you go to Mars, there's no coming back, not, you know, with the current state of technology. So we know we could probably get there, but it's a one-way ticket. So I was really intrigued by that people would be willing to give up, you know, the beauty of the Earth and all the interesting things. I mean, think of never going to a restaurant again or a sports game or a movie or any of the things we take for granted. Like, this would be a very cold and forbidding environment on Mars, and absolutely nothing. You'd land in the middle of a desert, and you would have to fend for yourself. There would be no, you know, no way to say, oh, I don't think I want to do this. Like, you were there, that's it. There's also this whole idea that there is currently a space race for who's going to be the first. Is it going to be SpaceX in conjunction with NASA? And or is it Mars One, or is it the Russians would have their own program, the Chinese, and so forth. So anyway, I wrote a thriller based on that idea that there was one space group that sent assassins over to slow the other space group that was getting ahead and looked like they were going to be the first to blast off. So it's a very good thriller if anybody's interested.
Well,
Crimson Firestorm Mars. Well, go ahead.
I was going to say, and the thing with Mars One, I followed that at the time too, and it was fascinating. The deal is, they finally ran out of money and funds, and they approached SpaceX, and it finally, they gave up.
Okay, very good. That's new stuff I didn't know, because at the time it was still very viable, and they had their hopes and dreams. Anyway, within that book, although it's fiction, I wrote a chapter called Otherworld Mysteries. And I got into the whole UFO question, shall we say, or all the stories, the conspiracies, the myths, and so forth about UFOs, because there is talk, like if you watch a show like Ancient Alien, they talk about how Mars may have once had a civilization and so forth.
Yeah.
Within that chapter, I had quoted Colonel John Alexander, whose book, UFOs, Myth, Conspiracies, and Realities, is just an absolute classic and one I highly recommend. The colonel is an Army insider, so he had contacts that we normal people don't have. That's what made it all the more believable. And I just found that the way he presented his information really indicated to me this was a man of integrity. So I had quoted him, and then I just decided, why not? I looked him up on the internet, and I sent him a message through Facebook and said, I quoted you in Crimson Firestorm Mars. May I send you a copy of the book? And he graciously replied, said, yes, be sure to sign it. He has an author's collection. I'm sure it's quite extensive, as John seems to know virtually everybody importance in certain arenas, shall we say. And you can, the readers can discover all that about John in the foreword that he wrote. It's a very extensive foreword.
Mm-hmm.
But once he had the book and told me he liked it and so forth, we were just going back and forth through Facebook, then I made a proposal to him about working on this book, The Journey Across Forever. Eventually, graciously agreed to write the book. So that's the story about how I got involved with John. And I've just found him to be an absolute delight and integrity. Like he's a no-nonsense man. That's what you want. Because there are so many stories about UFOs and aliens and all that. And the paranormal, you mentioned earlier about his book, Reality Denied.
Mm-hmm.
John, he was in the Army, and he had spoon-bending parties with Uri Geller-type, people sitting around and having actual forks and spoons bend inexplicably. And some may know he was part of the group that got into remote viewing. And the George Clooney movie, The Men Who Stare at Goats, was based in part on John and some of his other colleagues. So, John has, his life is just the most amazing life. So anyway, I encourage everyone to read the foreword of the book, but he also read the book. And, he offered suggestions here and there on things, and he put me through some hoops to make sure the information was as true and correct as I could make it, and then he's given me support ever since.
Wayne Solman, the website waynesolman.com. The book Journey Across Forever is available on Amazon. In the next segment, a UFO encounter and that JFK bombshell. Okay, not necessarily at the same time. A quick break. Talking about John Alexander in Reality Denied, one of the things, until most recently, that has been denied for decades, UFOs. In the book, Wayne talks about two UFO encounters. One was more than just a UFO.
You have that in your background.
Yes, I do. I did have, at a very young age, around 10 or 11, my brother and I were playing ball, just throwing a ball back and forth in our front yard in Ohio, where I was born there and raised. We were just in the front of our house throwing the ball back and forth. It was the middle of the day, sunny, perfect day, summer day, not a cloud in the sky, when a round flying craft came slowly over the top of the house and flew over us. Now, this was an unusual craft in that it was not typical flying saucer. It was round. It was metallic. but it was like a shuttlecraft, and it had a railing around it. And quite strangely, at the back was a man and a woman, and they looked like normal humans, but who had such a craft back in the 60s, you know, the early 60s?
Yeah.
And why have we never seen any since? So we waved up at the couple, and they waved down at us. They were a very handsome couple. They were like, they looked like they were dressed in Star Trek outfits. I mean, it was that kind of, they had like brown uniforms on of some kind. You notice like their hair wasn't flying in the wind or anything. So there seemed to be some kind of magnetic protective field around them. But there wasn't a sound to the vehicle. And it just flew over so slowly that we could wave up at them. They waved down at us. Then we were so excited, we ran into the house to get our mother. And she came out and she saw it flying off in the distance. That was my first encounter, which it took me years to realize that I had seen something so extraordinary that, you know, to this day, half a century later, I've never seen another one.
Yeah.
So somebody had very exotic technology at that point, and who they were, I don't know, but I'm guessing they were a humanoid couple, because, you know, we humans just don't have that kind of craft even to this day. That opened me, once I started realizing as I got older, you know, the impact of it kept at me, like, in a way that I would say, look, I saw this. This was clear as day. This was an exotic piece of technology which doesn't exist in our world so far as we know. So I believe, you know, it made me a believer that there is such a thing as flying saucers or UFOs or UAPs, as they're called. I think one of the really important... Go ahead.
I was going to say, trying to retitle it so they can kind of own that, you know, that, okay, I have the name, we claim ownership.
Yeah. Well, I think in fairness, they knew that the letters UFO, you know, there was such a program to ridicule people who had claimed they had seen these things that it was perhaps a wise move on their part, you know, to retitle it as unidentified aerial phenomena. We, as we know, on December 17th, 2017, the New York Times story was released about the Pentagon program that Luis Elizondo had been the head of. And he basically, I think that was a moment of disclosure where you have the New York Times releasing an article like that and saying, look, the evidence is there. There is such a thing. So I believe, like, without them coming out and saying it in so many words, but, you know, it's funny because that article was, like, buried on page 12 when I came across it in the newspaper. And I was just so amazed. But the Navy's videos of the Tic Tac, has been further, you know, confirmation that these UFOs are real. And now they're looking at it as, could it be a national security threat, you know, to airliners and such that are flying in and out of airports and so forth. So they're kind of taking that tack and tone to it.
That's the press release. So the fact that they've been out there since, you know, 1947, or at least that was the Roswell, the big, but before, prior to that, I mean, in the, I've got it on my wall. I have a newspaper clipping from the Topeka Capital Journal. That's in the Midwest in the USA, of a UFO sighting. And I'm sorry, I have to look at the date again. 1897, when they had a sighting here in the middle of Kansas. So it's been a long haul to finally get some kind of official acknowledgement. Okay.
Very, very true. And Jim Mars, who I met in Texas in the late 90s, and I write about in the book, he also told me, you know, about the story about the Texas UFO, or flying saucer that crashed into a windmill there in 1897 in Aurora, Texas. And we met in Aurora, Texas. We spent, you know, 3 or 4 hours together talking. And it was very, very interesting to hear Jim's take on it all. His book, Alien Agenda, is, I believe, the best-selling book on UFOs so far in history.
It's a classic.
And Jim is a very, very incredible investigative journalist, as you may know. Perhaps you interviewed him yourself.
I wish. I wish. I didn't get to him in time.
According to his book, you know, there are three broad groups. There's the humanoid Nordic group, then there's the Greys, made famous by Whitley Strieber, and then finally there's what he called the Transcendentals, which I absolutely loved that, the Transcendentals, because they are quite possibly who we've been calling angels for millenniums, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's very intriguing.
The byline here, the journey across forever, a magical mystery ride through the prism of history in a search for answers to humanity's highest dreams. And really a book of essays, basically kind of examining this from how did we get here and how you were shaped by your own history in terms of what you believe and some of the people that you followed, the people that you were able to meet. You actually have a list of recognizable names as you begin your search to become a novelist, a writer, a creator. You rubbed elbows with a lot of interesting people, and Timothy Leary was one.
Timothy Leary and Robert Anton Wilson. Here is another stroke of luck for me. I wrote my first book, which was, I've written four books of fiction. Okay, the first one was The Dream Illuminati. The title came after I was actually accepted by the Falcon Press. I had been introduced to the writings of Robert Anton Wilson and Timothy Leary and was really intrigued with the whole idea of the way they opened up to all possibilities. And they were, of course, famous for being into entheogenic substances, but also the mysteries of the mind and the paranormal and so forth all play into that, into their writing. These men were an incredible influence on the 60s culture. I had been reading Wilson, for one, his book Cosmic Trigger, which I write about in The Journey Across Forever, was like the most influential book on me because it really opened me up to a whole new way of looking at life and the paradigms that surround us and so forth. And 1 year only, Falcon Press put out an ad for submissions for just opening it up to the general public. Dr. Christopher S. Hyatt, who owned Falcon Press and ran it, he said he could have filled a room with all the submissions he got, but somehow mine was chosen, and I just called it Vimanas at that time, or something about Vimanas, because I was intrigued with this idea that in ancient India, the Vedic scriptures talk about these Vimanas that could fly across the sky and carried the gods and so forth. So I'm like, how could this be going on thousands of years ago? And why would they make this stuff up? And they weren't making it up. They were telling what they experienced. So I was a believer, and that's why the way I was looking at it. So I wrote this book about a group of flying mystics, as Robert Anton Wilson called them, that were living their dreams of flying. Like, they were having dreams of flying, and then they built these personal rocket packs, or fly packs, I call them, where, you know, you'd strap one on and you'd fly, you'd live out your dreams of flying. So I sent that story in, and it was accepted. And eventually, under the influence of Hyatt and Wilson, I retitled it The Dream Illuminati. And Robert Anton Wilson wrote an extensive introduction to the book, which ended up in his final book. It's called Emails to the Universe, and it's an essay called Dreams of Flying. So I was taken into the fold at that point. And then my second book was called The Illuminati of Immortality. And again, Wilson wrote an extensive introduction to that book. When I released The Dream Illuminati, I went to L.A. and Timothy Leary was there with his new book. I remember, well, I spent 3 days with Timothy Leary there in L.A., and that was super fascinating. He was just getting into computers. This was 1988. William Gibson was there, and he had, of course, written Neuromancer, which, you know, was the first book to talk about cyber things and the cyberpunk movement and cyberspace and all that. He was, without a doubt, the hottest writer on the planet at that time. And Timothy Leary was mad about his work, and he ran over to wherever Gibson was and brought him back to our booth, so he spent time with us there. So it was a very exciting time. You know, being able to talk to somebody like Tim for hours on end was just fascinating.
Another person you, along that same vein, not at the same time, but Terrence McKenna, you actually had a chance to connect with him, too. And that might not have been what people expect, because Terrence is... How do I say this? Complex. How's that?
Well, he was having an event in San Francisco. I lived in San Francisco for 15 years. He was giving a talk, but at the same time, he had music blasting from speakers while he kind of told his tales. If you're familiar with his work at all, he had one of the most brilliant minds you can imagine. Like, the man was just an amazing storyteller, and his use of language was just phenomenal. But he was giving one of his talks and had everybody all intrigued. There were videos behind him with UFOs and atomic bombs going off and all kinds of stuff like that. The music was very avant-garde stuff, and... Yeah, I had read his books, and I was thoroughly intrigued about the whole thing with entheogenic substances and so forth. Now, I've experimented, shall we say, but I was also the kind of person who did not do these substances just, you know, for fun. Whenever I engaged in it, there was a certain sacred component that always seemed to just prevail. It was very natural with me. It just seemed like I would suddenly see on multiple levels. And I was very, I've studied Jungian psychology in great depth. And the whole idea of the archetypes and so forth, it is like this would just fill my mind. And Terrence McKenna, likewise, you know, you could tell that all of this, he was reaching into very deep and profound areas of mystery and intrigue. And he was super well known, of course, in the community, the communities that are into the entheogenic substances and so forth. So yeah, that was an interesting experience. I didn't get to enjoy my time with him as much as I would have liked, because, you know, the event was going on. There were a lot of people there, but it was important to me to go and to experience that. I to this day think that his books are phenomenal, but I never bought into the whole end of history thing that he was pushing mm-hmm. at the time. And you know, the whole 2012 the end of history, he constantly talked about that.
Yeah, but a lot of people got sucked into that.
Yeah.
Along that line, conspiracy, this is kind of buried, a little gem in your essays about the time you lived in Dallas. And for people who were familiar with all of the conspiracies surrounding JFK, you actually, in my opinion, you hit pay dirt. This is like a little bombshell in there.
I know. It's like, I don't know what to make of it, because I met this woman. And she had been a stripper in Jack Ruby's club, which was quite intriguing. She had become a born-again Christian, so she was more or less trying to move on with her life. What happened to her is quite amazing, because she worked for Jack Ruby, who killed Lee Harvey Oswald. And Lee Harvey Oswald, of course, shot Jack Kennedy, John Kennedy. And she was married to a man who also worked for Jack Ruby. And on November 22nd, 1963, when John Kennedy was assassinated, her husband fled Dallas, and she never saw the man again. And one of the things left behind was a little notebook. And in the notebook, it was written, Oswald, $10,000. That's all it said. Oswald, $10,000. So you think about that. Jack Ruby was a mobster, basically.
Mm-hmm.
He killed Oswald to shut him up. And she told me she did not show this to the FBI because she didn't want to feel like she was ratting out her husband. She was afraid that he would get in trouble because she always thought he'd come back to her. But he never did. She never saw him again. And this was in the 80s. So it was already 20 years gone, you know, when I met her. But that is a true story. And the little notebook, she showed it to me. And I saw it scribbled there, Oswald, $10,000.
And you wonder what happened to her husband, if he actually was still alive.
Absolutely, yeah. Or I just imagine that he fled because he knew he was in it too deep. Like the FBI and the police and everybody would be pulling all these figures in and interrogating mm-hmm. them. So he said, I'm out of here.
Some of the experiences you've had with rocks, or at least what I interpret these power stones that you have run into, and you've had extraordinary experiences, what has it left you with?
Just to tell the Aborigine power stone story is briefly here to lead up to my conclusion. I was traveling in, I'd lived in Melbourne for 3 years and had traveled out to Perth for a holiday. And on the way back, just stopped totally at random in South Australia, decided to take time off, go down to the beach, relax for the afternoon, and then continue the journey back the next day. Well, I went in, I found a cave there. And when I looked inside the cave, it was right on the water, and I could see light inside the cave. And I thought, that's curious. So I crawled in the very low opening, but I crawled in, and basically there was a hole in the roof of the cave, and I knew that this was a blowhole when the tide was high. In the midst of that sunny patch of light was an oblong stone about as long as my forearm, and it had crisscrossing bands on it. And I thought, this is a really cool stone. I had no idea that it was actually an Aboriginal artifact, or I wouldn't have taken it, but I just thought it had been rolled in the surf in such a way that that was its natural shape. And I said, this is a really cool stone. I'm going to take this. Because I do collect stones and shells and things like a lot of people. Well, anyway, the next day when I got home in Melbourne, I just brought all the stuff in from the car, you know, and had it in the bedroom, just laying on the floor, the bags and whatever. And the stone was there. I took a shower, sat back on the bed and was reading a book of poetry as it happened. And at one point, I looked up, and the room had grown full of mist, especially up around the ceiling. You could really see a thick mist, and I had no idea what this was all about. And then I noticed that about eye level, there was a spiral spinning in the mist. So if the mist hadn't been there, I wouldn't have been able to see this energy form, this spiral, because the mist was there. I had a very clear view of this spinning spiral, and it was about as big as my arm also, so it was fairly sizable. And there was a clock right next to the bed, so for over an hour, I sat looking and more or less communing, like, you know, trying to understand what mystery was going on here, because this spiral was not disappearing. And I played with the light to make sure I wasn't fooling myself. And at one point, then the spiral came toward me and it entered me. and it kind of spun around. I could feel its energy, but it wasn't frightening. It was like, I felt like it was just checking me out. And then it backed off again, and there was this old Victorian fireplace there, and it kind of just stayed hovering there. And then a car engine started outside after the hour or so had gone by. And it started up very close to the house, so it seemed to just change the atmosphere in an instant. And I heard this crackling sound, and then the spiral shot up through the ceiling. And in an absolute instant, the room cleared of the mist, just absolutely vanished. Well, I didn't know at that point that this was associated at all with the rock that I brought into the house. I just thought it was a strange paranormal moment of some kind, but I had no idea exactly. Well, a few days later, this Australian couple came over, and when I showed them the rock, they said, I think this is an Aboriginal artifact, and, you know, it's against the law to move these things from their natural habitat. So that concerns me, but I had taken it innocently, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So about a week later, I was just out and about on a Saturday, and I went into the shop that sold Aboriginal art things, you know, like paintings and boomerangs and didgeridoos and all that kind of stuff. And there was an Aboriginal woman in there. So I told her about the stone, and she said, bring it to me. I have a friend who's a professor at the university. He's half Aborigine, and he will know if that is an Aboriginal artifact or not. So I did bring the stone in to her. She passed it on to the professor, and then he called the South Australian Aborigine Society, and they sent two Aboriginal shamans flying to Melbourne to collect that stone. That's how important it was to them. It was identified as a Turinga, which is a power stone. And the being, the spiraling being, was a dreamtime entity of some sort. Now, the Aborigines consider these their ancestors. You come from the dreamtime and you return to it. So I subsequently, to find out that this connection was there, what I learned from that is that there are, shall we say, non-human forms of life that do exist. And, you know, I experienced it with my own eyes, and it entered me and experienced me. So there was an exchange there. There was a communing of some kind. And that was a huge lesson for me, to realize that there are non-physical entities. And I had to wonder, when I heard and did a bit of research to find out, there are thousands of spirals pecked into rock all over Australia. They're called petroglyphs. I'm currently living in Ireland, and there's an ancient structure here called Newgrange, which has spirals also pecked in the rock. And that building is believed to be 5,000 years old. So is this kind of our natural spiritual energy form, I'm wondering? So I just put that out there, and people can draw their own conclusions, but that is what I experienced.
It also implies that, you know, we tend to believe in things that we can only see that are physical. But when you experience something that has no physical form whatsoever, and yet you're able to connect to, whether it's language or telepathic, whatever you hear, to know that there's more than what we see that is active in our reality. And the more you connect with that, I think the greater your ability to appreciate all life. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Well spoken. Yes, absolutely.
With the book, you have some wonderful contacts, Whitley Strieber, John Alexander, we mentioned before, and you've just had some great connections that draw people to a different reality when they're thinking creatively about the world. And I think that you've accomplished a lot by getting people to become more open-minded and maybe open to traveling, as you have traveled all over the world. there's just a benefit to seeing other cultures and reading about other cultures and experiencing, like you did, that shamanic experience with the Aboriginal rock artifact.
Yes. That's it. We have to keep an open mind and try to experience as many cultures as we can and see the world, read books, write if you're inclined to, because it helps to clarify your thinking. I'm just a great believer in the power of dreams. One of the chapters is about dream yoga, which I've had multiple experiences through dreams that have convinced me about this other realm, shall we say, or the other world of legend. And so there are stories about that in here. I want to inspire people to see the world as what it is in terms of, you know, we take so much for granted when really you can find such beauty in the world and miraculous things if you open your mind to it. I think we need to find the sacred in the profane in order to be whole and to be multidimensional beings, truly the multidimensional beings we are. So it's a journey around the world, but it's also a journey within. And even if you don't travel, you can meditate and dream and read and keep expanding your mind and your spirituality. Find, you know, your spiritual self and keep expanding that, because I very much believe life goes on when the body no longer functions, that we transition into another realm, and that I think we will reincarnate if that is our particular fate, or we might move on to higher realms that are non-physical. So anything's possible. Stay open-minded. That's my main message. And I've just been a searcher all my life. I've been on a quest to find these answers since I was very young. So interestingly, it was the Beatles who inspired me to go to the Far East when they went to India to pursue Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. You know, the 60s were a time of mind expansion, shall we say, and opening every possibility in the idea that we might be in a new age, an Aquarian new age. So all of that is in the book. I very much hope that readers will look into it and, you know, read The Journey Across Forever and put up their thoughts on Amazon or whatever source they want to remark on it, or at least talk about it with their friends and so forth.
And your website too.
Yeah, you're welcome to look at my website and read my essays. I have essays on medium.com, and some of them appear in the book and some don't, but I'm also working on a new book now we'll see when, maybe next year or possibly 2 years. I'm in no rush. I want to make sure the work is high quality, you know, and everything is genuine. Like, there's no room for deluding yourself about truth. As a certain Zen master said, he says, never mind seeking truth, you know, just let false views cease. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the ticket. Like, just get past your own delusions and the things you've been acculturated into believing and indoctrinated into believing. So I'm very much a proponent of spiritual liberation. Just open up the people who have returned from the afterlife, who had a near-death experience, say there's no particular religion in the afterlife. The only thing that matters is how you treated other people. And it's all about love and kindness and enlightenment and goodness. So that, to me, is very exciting and gives me great hope about my life on Earth and when I move on.
The book you're working on, is it fiction or nonfiction?
It's nonfiction. So there's more stories, believe it or not. And I just love mining all the things that have happened. You know, as we grow older, a lot of people fear growing older, but we do grow wiser because wisdom comes from life experience. And it's quite amazing to just find little things that happened that you may have just thought, oh, that was strange or whatever. But when you really look into them, you find they're significant. They're very significant.
I'll put links in the description for the show so you can connect with Wayne. Thank you for listening again. The book,
Journey Across Forever, A Magical, Provocative Odyssey Across the Ages, Around the World and Into the Great Beyond.
Available now at Amazon, also on the website, waynesalman.com.